of other universities where we're well located in a scientific community. We're all supposed to move over to the UC Santa Cruz and Santa Cruz area. The half of us are there, half of us are in Menlo Park. The rest of us are supposed to be in 2 years, but that 2 years window has been sliding for about 15 years. Someday we'll all be in Santa Cruz in what's called the Monterey Bay Research Triangle that encompasses Mbari to the south in Monterey Bay. Mbari stands for Monterey Bay Aquarium Research Institute, there are maybe 14 to 18 different scientific agencies in the Monterey Bay region. And so we want to get into that pool, or some of us do, some of us don't. If you've had your whole career in Menlo Park and your spouse or significant others are doing other work, moving 50, 60 miles away really puts a stress on. At any rate, money has kept some of us in Menlo Park and the rest of us. Whenever we hire a new postdoc or a researcher, they usually end up in Santa Cruz, but unfortunately they're
I got one of those. And I'm
So that was it for the introduction. I'm just going to do a little show and tell here about some of my labs, primarily on the core end. But I've got seven or eight labs. I have a core lab, two refrigerated core facilities, one on campus, about 900 square feet. Menlo Park warehouse, about a mile and a half, 2 miles away, in a set of warehouses we rent several years ago in late 2006. Put in a $300,000 box, a 40 by 80 box, 3,200 square feet, 12 feet high. We have an x-ray lab, which has very old x-ray equipment, but it works. We have two core logging systems, the Geotechs, one of their versions, the early versions, and then one that's probably 3 or 4 years old. They both work. The newer version works in the lab as well as it goes out to sea. And it gets your physical properties, things like that. And then I have five sediment labs that do everything from grain size analysis, heavy mineral separations, preparations in my lab for samples that may go out to other labs or institutions for quantitative stuff. We also have five or six geochemistry labs as well. We've got a whole bunch of stuff.
Mike, the Menlo Park warehouse box, you call it. Is it in an existing structure?
It's in a big, about 100-yard-long warehouse.
Okay.
And it really has saved me money. I used to have two smaller boxes out where our ships were docked in Redwood City, and they were out on tarmac. Two boxes that were maybe 30 by 50, and my electric bills were through the roof, trying to keep it warm. So
can you tell us what it costs? That's a new installation.
That cost me $300,000. The box itself was bid in $220,000, does not count the racks or anything, just the box, which is 6-inch thick pieces of styrofoam sandwiched in between thin aluminum sheets. Like you'll find at most fish storage, I'm sure you drive around here, you'll find very similar. This company I have contracted has installation outlets all across the state. They're called cold storage manufacturing or something like that. But that was $220,000 to build a box, but by the time the city of Menlo Park and the county of San Mateo got done with us, even though it was a federal government and we can pretty much give the middle finger to anybody, we try to work with our local municipalities to do exactly what they want us to do. So I had to build a ramp for a handicapped people to get into the refrigerator, which, I'm never going to have someone in a wheelchair working in my refrigerator pulling cords out, but I had to do that. I had to pave a large area for the parking lot, and then for cars to park a little better. So by the time you're done, it's about $310,000. But the box itself, in 2006, $220,000. That's 3,200 square feet, 12 foot high. Being inside a warehouse, like I said, my electric bills just went up to about a third All my motors, everything are inside, except the, one of the cooling systems is outside, but it's also in the shade. It's one thing I, when I was being moved from one facility to another, I wanted to get my costs way down. So.
Did you have to insulate the slab as well?
No, that slab was poured in 1949. It, Menlo Park Campus was a hospital for Korean War. And eventually became the U.S. Geological Survey. So they poured these warehouses about a mile and a half away from where we are at about the same time, and it was a different owner. And then we released these four or five warehouses. It's on a street called O'Brien Drive, and there's 10, 20, 30, 40, 50, and 60. And we have leased all those buildings. We have a 20-year lease that every 3 or 4 years we kind of extend, so we always know we've got a 20-year window. Menlo Park campus is shrinking. We used to have about 1,200 people on campus between the earthquake team, the, you know, the various teams. I'm in coastal marine geology. That has now shrunk down to about 450 on campus, and they want it between a reduction in force we had in 1995 and people just leaving on their own and not being replaced. And it's USGSY, the Water Resources Division, the Geologic Division, which I'm a part of. And the National Mapping Division have pretty much been, you know, ripped from the survey, and some of them are up in South Dakota. But we've reduced, and they want to get the rest of us, as I said earlier, from the coastal marine team over into Santa Cruz, which will take about another 50 or 60 people away from campus. And then the General Services Administration is leasing the buildings out that we're vacating to other government agencies. So, anyway. Again, my sediment labs, anything you use a sediment lab for, I've got four or five different types of particle size analyzers, 2 meter tall settling tubes for size analysis of sand to get settling velocities. I've got two different laser diffraction particle sizing systems, both Beckman Coulter. One is very old, one is relatively new, and I've got a setograph. Beckman Coulter, the laser diffraction basically is a particle counter and gives you an approximate size based on the volume, and the setograph I have is for fine particles, 63 microns, and finer, and it settles your particles, and with an X-ray beam will determine based on Stokes' law of size. And I also have carbon analyzers, and we have a whole another geochemistry set of geochem labs that goes from organic to inorganic, and a whole array of stuff. And I'm again mostly focusing on what we have as far as refrigerated core storage. This is what's on campus. We've got a whole series of...
Is there a laser on this?
There is, and there's a red dot in the middle.
Ah, there you go. These are wooden bins, but these are uni-strut shells. I don't know if people are familiar with uni-strut, but it's channel steel that you can bolt together. These are about 8 feet high. And there's wooden bins here that roll around. I've got a few chest reasons. These are wooden bins I've built myself that are 2 by 2 by 2. And we just stuck. In the last 5 to 8 years, we've shifted from collecting a two-ship operation, collecting cores all over the Pacific and the Arctic region, all the way down to Antarctica, to, you know, now we just lease vessels of opportunity. Years ago, we were involved with Guy Rockwell's group, IOS, and we used Farnella for years, UNOR, Gloria, which was a long-range sighting sonar mapping of the whole EEZ of the United States. At any rate, after we make our maps, we go out and collect cores. But lately, now we're doing a lot of habitat work, so in these bins, I get little World Pack bag samples. And I'm collecting a few cores a year, but primarily lots of samples that are just small grabs, tambines, box core samples, but not the big, deep cores that we used to collect. Here's the facility in Menlo Park, the wooden bins here that have small samples or box core slabs, which is what I'm holding. And then to the right, the shells, you can see unsplit cores and split cores going into D-tubes. This is pretty cramped. It's pretty much full now. And it's primarily for active cores because it's adjacent to my core lab here. You can see me here, a standard DSDT core splitting device. My son, who I'm training not to be a geologist, we've got a digital camera, and you can lay your split cores out and photograph them, but we also have the Geotech logger we have also has a camera on it, which is far better than what we have here. But every now and then someone pops in and wants to take a quick shot of a 10-meter section of corn and get it flowing. So we have a portrait-style camera. And again, I got a light table that I can lay out x-rays on so you can do your work. There's a picture of the old corn logger, the oldest geodetic system that's at least 10, 12 years old. And there's the old Mac SE that it runs on. That died about a year ago, and we just sent emails out all over the planet. And next thing you know, a couple hard drives showed up from somewhere, and it's now running again. The newer one was out to sea, so I didn't get a picture of it. Here's one of my three core x-ray systems. You can lay a core down here. There's an x-ray head here and a cathode tube here, which captures a video image. What I use this for is you can run, let's say you come back with 40 cores. You can run them all under this after you've split it. See which ones may, fit your work desk, and rather than go back and x-ray everything on film and generate about 100,000 gallons of hazardous waste for me to deal with, you can pick a subset of samples to do your final x-rays on. So this thing gives us video. You can look at it. It's old. It's funky. I don't really like it, but I don't have a quarter of a million or more than I need to get up to the modern age. Here's a simple veterinarian's x-ray system. I welded together a small aluminum frame, and you can lay pieces of core under there. This I bought primarily to go in the field. Sometimes people are doing drill. We've got studies going on in Southern California dealing with saltwater intrusion as they've been draining the basin, the LA basin, and the freshwater for agriculture and municipal use. They've sucked in the Pacific Ocean, and as a result, it's a big problem all over coastal communities. I send this out when they're doing drills with some of our collaborators, or out to sea. It went out on a gas hydrate cruise somewhere here in the Gulf several years ago. And the nice thing is, I don't know much about x-rays, but they say it was soft. So there's an umbilical cord here, and you can stand 3-4 feet away and take the shots. And I've had badges on my ankles and sides of my body that are near that, and they've never turned up positive for exposure. So it's a simple light system, costs about $6,000. Clark Alexander, actually, of Skidaway, turned me on to this system. And this is cheap. People can burn it out easy if they overuse it, but they're easy to replace. I have a third x-ray right there. This is a 1975 is when we bought this particular unit, just after I came on with the survey. It's like an oven, but it's great. It's got a rolling window. It auto-exposes, and it's great. We get a lot of samples from Stanford University. They do a lot of work down in coral reef regions. They're dating coral reefs and seeing how climate is affecting them, so you go back in time. It's good for rock and other coral, and even thin sediment slabs. A lot of times when we x-ray the half rounds, you don't get a really good image, so you can flip a half round core out, cut a slice out of it, a nice thin, centimeter, 2-centimeter slab, and then put it on there, and resolution improves dramatically. There's, again, my light table. And again, since it's film, you have to run it through a film processor. I think it's currently broken, and I should have parts by the end of the week to have it running pretty soon. Here's my Menlo Park warehouse facility here. There's the whole warehouse. Oop, that's the wrong one. And again, this is about, maybe not 100 yards long, but it's pretty big. There's more of the building you do not see. But this area here is my box of 3,200 square feet. And these here are all shelves built with Unistrut that run 10 feet high. And the area here, area I, are these plastic collapsible palletized containers that I switched to in 2006 and 2007. That's where I will buy a bunch of Rubbermaid tubs and put all our bag samples in. We barcode pretty much everything, unless you've got a million bag samples. And then the container they go into gets barcoded, and then the pallet gets barcoded, so we kind of keep track of everything we have. And this year, I have turned this area into a small lab. So you can bring, rather than bring all your cores back, rather than have me or my part-time assistant have to go and grab the cores of the whole cruise where the cores and bring them back to Menlo Park to my labs, now you can come in, pull cores here that are already split and described, and if you have some metadata or the local co-chief is still around, then you can work in this area here. We have layout tables and stuff. and start looking at your course. And that's just a blow-up of the same thing. And here's some shots of the inside. Again, these racks here are 10 feet high. I forget what the gauge of the uni strut is we used, but this facility is pretty full too. And it started in late 2006, so I got a problem coming up real quick. The thing that saved me is the drop-off in the number of cores we've collected, but I'm getting lots of small samples, bag samples, grass samples, things like that. And there's these palletized containers here. And, the fire department has been in several times, and they're already upset with me crowding, you know, blocking egress. But there's nothing I can do. I can't put these things outside. I guess I could, but when we run into that was my last talk. Now my database. It's not mine. I'm not really a database person. I got about 20 different jobs at the USGS. I do manage our core facility with a person that helps me maybe 10 hours a week at most. When I gave this talk last time, I had a full-time curator. She went to halftime, and they wisely, I don't know, let her go. And now I've got another person who's a side-scan sonar and LIDAR processor who 8 hours a week tries to help me out. But it's manpower and budget. But this is our database. You can find it here at this website, or you can just go in and type in usgs.gov, and the name of our database is where the black arrow is, called InfoBank. Probably, I would be willing to bet Carla knows more about InfoBank than I do. I avoid it because I pretty much know where everything else is, and I don't like exactly the way it's set up. I don't think in the same terms as the guy that set this up. But if you were to go to our website, you can get information on what we do, you know, our little weekly or monthly newsletter, things like that, and our top 10 pages. But off to the side, you'll see there's all sorts of data that you can go grab or even ask questions, ask the geologists, a lot of students from schools all over the world hit us questions. We all kind of are on a rotating thing where one day every 2 or 3 months you spend some time answering questions for the general public. So if you click on InfoBank, a page like this might pop up, and you might want to find out about my facilities or where things are, so you could click over here on labs. This I made just by stumbling through and grabbing these images. Sorry, Brian, somehow this hole did not show up on this map, but this just shows you what we have. I was having a fight with your boss.
Fair enough.
I don't get along with you. Anyway, there's some directions on how to get to all of our facilities, say Pete, Woods Hole, whatever. MARFAC stands for Marine Facility, where all our welders, I'm there part-time because sometimes I go out to sea as a winch operator or a crane operator rather than as a scientist, so I wear many different hats in the organization. But you can bring this page up, and then down here you'll see our geochem labs, the SED labs, micropaleo lab, and here's some of my labs down here too as well. So if you were to click, for example, on sediment core splitting description, you get a page like this that pop up. There's the name of our old curator. It's now a guy named Greg Gable. I know that I have a facility in Building 15. That's my main thing on campus. So you click here. It brings up the map of the image. And then you can access the map of the refrigerator. And you can start clicking on these shells and things here. And if you note at the top, you'll see we have every container has a number, and our database, like Clint, calls a shelf a container because on that shelf are cores. So the shelves are barcoded, the cores are barcoded. There's a lot of barcoding. At any rate, if you were to click, for example, on this image, exactly the portion of the shelves that you click on comes up here. And you'll see column one, column two. We have our vertical posts that support things that are about 5.5 feet apart. So that's a column. Across that column, there's all the rows. And so the way I click through here is I brought up activity IDs, whatever it may be, a cruise or some like drilling on land. We do have some drill cores here and there, and these are the activity IDs, and I know that's Westminster, California, 1997, you know. And so you can click on that, and this page will pop up, and this page shows you who Carl Wentworth was the chief scientist of this particular cruise. This item ID number here is the barcode number, actually. disposition. Are these samples we're keeping? Are we going to ship to other institutions? I've done some shipping here to Anders and somebody here when I got rid of our Antarctic collection when we were moving because we're just, space is a problem. Anyway, it tells you what core section it is, the interval in centimeters, whether it's working or archived. And we find bugs or mistakes in this all the time, so it's up to us or users that are working with us. Get back to me and to Clint so he can go in and find the mistake he has on the particular page that he has brought up. You can now go into our Menlo Park warehouse facility at O'Brien Drive, and again, you can click on that particular area F. It'll bring up, when I brought this up, I brought it up with activity ID numbers here. Let's say you click on column 5, 12096, and this particular page comes up. And this has been updated since I last shown it, so, and that's what I'm showing here now, is that we've added and perfected a Google Earth feature. So before it took me forever to find out longitude and latitude for any sample we had. It just, for some reason, not put where I wanted it put, and I'm not the database guy, so I don't get that. But this page comes up, and you can see, I brought it up so that I can see what the activity name of this is, D185AR. I know that's the NOAA Ship Discoverer, first cruise of 1985, and it's in the Arctic. Chief Scientist Peter Barnes, Larry Phillips, both retired in the last few years, and what core sections they want. If you were to click on that activity ID right there, it'll bring up this page. And there's our metadata. This tells you a quick little abstract on the top, chief scientists, what they use from a 3.5 side scan, seismic, and seismic there was probably 3.5 kilohertz, and maybe a mini sparker or a small air gun. So those types of data are all listed in this little abstract, and where it was, the Beaufort Sea, the Chukchi Sea, and the range of the cruise from September 5th of 85 to October 6th. And if you then go to the sample line here and click GE for Google Earth, this will pop up, so you know you're on the North Slope, at least I do. These are all the samples that were collected aboard Discover in 1985 with Peter and Larry, and some of them are box cores, pipe dredges, whatever. And then if you were to click on one of the sample sites, you'll see that that site there, they actually took three samples, but longitude, latitude comes up, the depth, and something about the core. It's a full box so that they know they had a good recovery. And we had this in 2007 2007 at the last meeting, but it had a lot of problems, so I didn't show it then. But now Clint and Carolyn have perfected it, and so you can use Google Earth to bring up all sorts of stuff. We can click that and bring up the seismic profiles, you know, that they ran and find out whether we have that data. A lot of that data in those days was both paper, because when you're running seismic, you've got a chart record a lot of times that's spinning out. We've now gone all digital, but so we have lots of paper records of 3.5 kilohertz, mini sparker data, you know, sub-bottom seismic reflection, as well as sonar. Long-range Gloria, we use multi-beam now quite a bit for just about everything we do. So all that makes it into our database, but unfortunately, and it's a manpower and money issue, Clint can't get the results of analyses on this page, which I want. I'd love to be able to go to the x-rays, but it's not just Clint's fault. We've had scientists that have since retired and passed on, and their shelves and their drawers are full of old x-rays. And personally, I don't have the time to go and collect data from over 200 to 300 people of x-rays that span back to the late 60s when we were, first became a team and get those digitized. I'd love to be able to employ Carla services, but for me to go out and try to gather that information, again, I've been trying for years. The general response I get from most of the researchers is check the publications. And it does nothing for me to get data out in case you want to look at an x-ray that I might have from the Arctic, and it's frustrating. So egos, politics, money, and manpower involved. And I guess I've covered some of this. Updates since 2007, Google Maps is now working better. I mentioned this earlier, we have a collaboration with Envari. A year ago, finally signed an MOU that was started by the late Bill Normark, of the USGS, Marsha McNutt, who's the head of Embari, and Charlie Paul, who's one of their Embari's researchers. And they have warehouses in the Watsonville area. They lease, it's an agricultural area, the Monterey Bay region. So there are lots of warehouses that keep things cold. Well, they didn't want to spend money on keeping things cold, and they had a whole collection of, I guess it was about 8 cores that were things just sitting on the floor in a warehouse, but with lots of sections to it. And so we signed the MOU. I acquired the core collection, both refrigerated and non-refrigerated sample, and they're all generally from the Monterey Bay shelf, Monterey Canyon, and the fan system, out almost to 200 miles. So we've got lots of cores that we've acquired from there, as well as the bar, and it saves them a lot of money. They don't have to worry about buying D-tubes now. They just tell me what to do. The sad thing about this is as soon as I got the MOU pushed through, they let my core curator full-time go, and she volunteered for a while, but, you know, you can only volunteer to do work with that, and about 3 months ago, I've got this person that's basically a LIDAR and side-scan sonar programmer who doesn't want to learn multi-beam. He's close to retirement, so he's now learning how to move cores and shuffle things around for me, but it's quite frustrating when I have someone that was actually good, say, budget, they let her go and gave me a guy 8 to 10 hours a week, so I'm kind of spinning my wheels here. But that's it.